You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds a significant backlog of infrastructure projects throughout the metro Milwaukee area. We'll learn more about the state roads, highways, and more in Wisconsin in just a bit. First, the Associated Press published a photo last week of Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez and his two-year-old daughter, Angie Valeria. The picture showed that they had drowned trying to cross the border from Mexico in an attempt to claim asylum in the U.S. It sparked a big reaction, with Congress ultimately passing an emergency border funding package a day later. It's not the first picture to have an effect. Images like the photo of Emmett Till and those from the Vietnam War have all triggered big reactions during their time, but our next guest says many of those responses can be short-lived. Paul Slovic is a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon. He's the founder and president of Decision Research, an international research group that looks at how we make complex and risky decisions. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
We've been hearing about this crisis at the border for months. What is it about an image like this one that can really, I guess, cut through the words and impact the way we feel about something in the news?
Well, clearly this struck an emotional chord and virtually everyone who saw it. The question is, why this image? We've had other strong images of refugees and asylum seekers before this one, and we have had more since. So there was something special about this image, just as there was something special a couple of years ago when the Syrian refugees, Aylan Kurdi and his family, when Aylan was washed up on the shore of the beach in Turkey, and that sparked a similar reaction. So we know that pictures can be very powerful emotionally, and the real question is, why does it take a photo when we have the information, we have the data before the photo? We shouldn't have to wait for a photo to wake us up.
Yeah, we heard from Kelsey on Facebook who says she has a child who is that girl's age, and she broke down talking to her husband about the story. Does that answer your question in part, that image can personalize the story for us in a way that the data can't?
Absolutely. We know that our emotional brain reacts very strongly to images of individuals. One person kind of maximizes our emotional connection. And then rather strangely, as if there are multiple images or many people in a photo, we react less because we can't connect to an individual there. So we're wired to react strongly to individuals or a couple of people, you know, that are kind of a individual group. And I think in this case also, it was important that the father and his daughter were dressed in a way, you know, kind of like we dress. We can identify with them, unfortunately, and that makes a big difference also in how we react.
I want to dig into something you mentioned there, that picture of one, or in this case, two people we feel that strong personal connection with. As we get more images or more data, more people, we might react less to the problem. Why?
I think it's because we're reacting with emotionally. So there's two ways we can process this information about something that's going on in the world that is, you know, a big problem. One is through kind of our gut feelings, our emotions, and that's how we usually react. The other is to kind of think logically and carefully, slowly about what's really going on here, what's the problem, and how serious is it. We tend not to do that because that's hard work. So when we think quickly, then the image affects us and it triggers feelings. And the thing that we've learned in research is that our feelings are innumerate. I mean, it's a strange term, but our feelings can't count. They can't multiply. They can't scale up very well. We feel so strongly when we see an individual in distress. Then we see many people. There's kind of nowhere for our feelings to go. They're already kind of maximized at one. And then also, we can't focus our attention on any one individual, and our attention, you know, wanes, it gets diverted, and then we lose it. and our feelings drop and we don't react. So we have a saying that, you know, the more who die, the less we care. And that's what happens when we rely only on our feelings and don't think carefully about the reality of what's really going on to cause this problem.
Talking to Paul Slovic, professor of psychology at the University of Oregon, about the power of images, tragic images like the one we're talking about from the U.S. border, others throughout history, how they can affect individuals, how they can affect decisions. Paul, is part of the story here, too, that, okay, one person we can perceive ourselves helping them with a donation or whatever. If it's dozens of people or hundreds or thousands, we feel powerless in the face of that?
Absolutely. That's a very important thing to help us understand why we react less when the problem is bigger. And again, it relates to relying on our feelings and our feelings being deceived by not being able to grasp certain elements of the situation. So, for example, we help others not only because they need our help, but we feel good about helping them. We refer to it as kind of the warm glow of compassion or that we get, you know, and that motivates us, the anticipation of feeling good. And supposing we learned that, oh, we can help this child, but unfortunately, there's another child over here you can't help. Well, the negative feeling that we have by seeing another child that we can't help comes in and it mixes with the good feeling we had about helping the child we can help and diminishes that good feeling. So it doesn't feel as good to help this child when you realize that there's someone else you can't help. And therefore, many people then would be less likely to help because it doesn't feel as good. Well, that's not rational. I mean, we shouldn't be deterred from helping someone just because we can't help everyone. And so we need to be aware of the fact that you don't have to do it all in order to make a significant difference. We have a saying that, you know, even partial solutions can save whole lives. Don't be demotivated because you can't fix the whole problem.
We heard from TV Tong on Facebook, who says these images are tragic and horrible, but nothing is ever done about them. When we talk about the image of the brutalized body of Emmett Till changing the discussion about civil rights, or the picture of Syrian kids injured or killed in a war changing policy, did they really, or did we just have this reaction and then they didn't really have that big an impact?
Sometimes they do make an impact. And what happens is that the photo can wake us up and get us caring, and that gives us a window of opportunity when we want to act. And if there's something that we see we can do, then we'll do it. If we don't feel there's anything we can do about it, then it makes sense to kind of turn it off, to turn our attention to something else, you know, problems, other problems in our lives that we need to attend to and maybe can do something about. So we studied the impact of the photo of Alan Kurdi, the boy on the beach, the Syrian refugee, and we looked for example at Google searches before for under the search term Syria and refugees before that photo. Now remember, the photo was in 2015, and the Syrian war started in 2011, and there were like 250,000 deaths, you know, of mostly civilians in Syria up to the point of that photograph. 250,000 deaths, and when we looked on Google searches, no one was interested in searching for anything about Syria or refugees. And then suddenly that picture came out, and the next day you see a huge spike in people searching under that term. And that spike kind of gradually diminished, and it took about a month to diminish. Well, that's a window of opportunity where people wanted to act. And one of my colleagues is in Sweden, and Sweden took in 150,000 Syrian refugees in 2015, an amazing number. And they set up a fund in the Swedish Red Cross to try to, you know, get money to care for these refugees. And before the photo came out, that fund was gathering about $8,000 a day. The day after that the picture came out, the donations went from 8,000 to 430,000. So we see a really powerful impact of that photo. And then, of course, it tailed off over the next month. So where the photo made people want to help And where there was something they could do, like donate to the Red Cross, they did it big time. But then after, then the question is, well, what do you do next to, you know, to deal with the Syrian problem? Most people didn't know what else to do. And over time, then that reaction stopped. And, you know, months or a year later, the situation for Syrians and Syrian refugees was no better than it was before. So the window of opportunity had closed, and things went back to where they were before.
We're talking to Paul Slovic from the University of Oregon about the impact that shocking, tragic images in the news can have on us. Paul, a few weeks back, I talked to Kim Phuc Phan Thai. She was the girl in the picture that was called Napalm Girl, the girl who had been burned by napalm in the course of the Vietnam War. Her life was transformed by the experience and the picture. She's now embraced a role as an ambassador of peace and trying to advocate for kids in war zones. Do you think there's a percentage of the population out there who, when they see something like this, doesn't have that only momentary reaction, but like Kim Phuc does, devotes their lives to an issue?
Absolutely. It can be clearly a life-changing experience, and you know, that's wonderful when it happens. And when it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to change your life to motivate you to do something significant to help others. So, I mean, the photo, there's all, you know, extremes as to how powerful the impact can be. And obviously for Kim, it was a very, very powerful. But these images do make a difference. I mean, it's not surprising that with the crisis we have on our borders in Texas and Florida with these detention centers for children, that people are not, that the journalists are not allowed in there to take pictures of what's going on. I think the people who run those centers know what the effect would be if we had images coming out of those detention camps.
Do you have thoughts for journalists based on your research?
Well, I think journalists understand not only the power of a photograph, but also the power of a story. So just like photographs can wake us up, so can stories of individuals who are suffering abuse in various ways. So these narratives can cut through what we call the psychic numbing that occurs when you just hear the statistics of the story. The statistics numb us, but stories as well as photographs can penetrate that and connect us emotionally to the problem. Journalists know that. Nicholas Kristof, for example, typically tries to get us to care about some larger problem by giving us a story of an individual or a family that's being affected by that problem.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Pullman. Paul, hello. Paul,
hello,
are you there?
Good afternoon.
Yep, go ahead.
I am here. Well, it's terrible what's happening on the on the southern border, and nobody wants to see anybody die. That's wrong. But I think the point to remember is, if you're going to take it from the news media, the story that goes with the picture, and how that picture is presented as to who caused it, why it's here. Certain liberal news organizations that blame it all on the government. And then you go to a different a conservative news outlet, and they frame the story a whole different way. So a guy's got to be really careful where you get your news, how you get your news. And, you know, something like 400 people died last year. I'm sure it's way up this year already.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Paul, making the case people are skeptical of what they see in the media, even an image. If you go in with concerns about the outlet that's presenting it to you, you may doubt whatever it is.
Sure, and people, the caller indicated that people might react differently to the image and interpret it different ways. I think the important thing is that the image can wake us up and get us to care about a problem when before we saw it, We weren't. We weren't paying any attention to it. So once you are paying attention, sure, try to get the facts, as best you can, in order to guide you as to whether or not you want to try to do something to help with the problem. So absolutely, get the facts, but the image can motivate you to do that.
Paul, thanks for the call. We're talking to Paul Slovic, psychology professor at the University of Oregon, about the impact of powerful images in the news, whether they can spur us to action. Back to your calls. Rick is on the line in Janesville. Rick, hello.
Hi, yes. I wanted to just mention the moral and the ethical responsibility of the person who is taking the image. I'm an educator, and I will show my students the image of the African child kind of hunched over. I think the photo's from the 70s, hunched over, on the savanna, and lurking behind it, there's a vulture or a buzzard. And, I ask my students, what's going on here or with the image? And not very many talk about the person who's taken the image who can provide help. And then we talk about the ethicals. Is it okay to take an image, or should we provide help?
Rick, thanks a lot for that call. Paul, I believe, and this is, don't quote me on this, I believe I read about that story and that the photographer did help that kid afterward, but can you talk about that ethical issue that Rick raises?
Right. Yeah, of course, one should provide help if you can. But I think the ethical issue is important. And the question is, are we, first, do all these images desensitize us? Well, yes, you can get desensitized to images just like to numbers. The other problem is that, is it ethically right to kind of violate this person's, humanity by showing an image of them, like we saw the father and daughter, and that's a tough question as well. I tend to feel that in these situations where people are being abused in such horrible ways that they're already being violated by what's happening to them, and if an image can mitigate this problem, can lead to, a change so other people aren't harmed this way, then I think in a benefit-cost sense, I would say that that one should show these images, and because they can lead to change and help other people.
Thanks for that call, Rick. Time for one more caller. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Good afternoon. There's been a lot of photos coming up from our southern border, specifically one with the father and his daughter that did not make it across the border. It's tragic and it's sad. But at the same time, the Red Cross reports that approximately over 1 million women and children have been killed in the Middle East over the past 20 years due to U.S. aggression. Now, I'd like to hear your guest comment about the difference where these current pictures are coming out readily every day. But for the past 20 years, we have not seen pictures of all the women and children being killed in the Middle East, and how those two compare and discompare. I would be interested to hear you guys speak on that. Thank you.
Mike, thanks for the call. Paul, when bad things are happening and we don't have those pictures to motivate us.
Yes, we. The further away, this the problem is occurring, the less likely we are to see images. Sometimes it's difficult for journalists to get in and photograph what's going on in these hot spots like in Syria or Myanmar and other places. So that's another problem. I agree. These things tend to be underreported. Not only do we have fewer photographs, there's all kinds of genocides and mass atrocities occurring right now in the world, and we're getting relatively little information about it. I think sometimes the press feels that people aren't interested, and so they don't cover it. But in any event, it's not covered adequately, the things that are happening far away. The stuff on the border we see is it's politically hot, it's imminent, we feel it's going to affect us, so it's more likely to be covered. I think all of this should be covered adequately by the media.
In just our last few moments, Paul, do you have thoughts on how we can, if we want to not desensitize ourselves, how we can keep that empathy going?
Yes. First, we should be aware of the fact that this can be a problem for us, and we should, when you read a story about something happening that's big in scope, and you see the numbers, you know, see thousands or hundreds of thousands of people being affected, stop and pause and try to imagine the individuals beneath the surface of the numbers, you know, that are being affected of this. Think of individual stories, and that will help you, I think, try to connect to the reality of what's going on.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Rob.
That's Paul Slovic, professor of psychology at the University of Oregon. He's with us today to talk about whether powerful images can really push us to take action and how to counteract our tendency, maybe natural tendency, to feel like our own actions don't matter or to turn off the more data we get about bad things happening in the world. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe a picture that struck you strongly in the past decades. You can do that at the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For residents of Milwaukee and the surrounding area, recent research into the metro's infrastructure paints a bleak picture. Between a lack of maintenance for roads and the water system to an aging bus fleet, the area has a backlog of projects that could top out at $400 million over the next 4 years. The problem may get worse as time goes on. Our next guest joins us to talk about that research. Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you crunched numbers over the last couple of years, really, on everything from roads to sewers to buildings to bridges. Rob, stack up for us for local governments in the Milwaukee area. How big is this burden of infrastructure needs versus what can they afford to pay?
Well, it's pretty big, Rob. I think it's important to distinguish between the three major local governments that we looked at. We looked at Milwaukee County, the city of Milwaukee, and the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. The good news is, in terms of the sewerage district, the problem isn't bleak at all. They're staying on top of their infrastructure needs. They have a very detailed long-range plan. They have a plan to pay for their needs. The cautionary element there is it's an expensive plan, and it means that property taxpayers are going to have to be able to swallow hard and absorb increases of up to 4% per year. When we look at the city of Milwaukee, we see certainly nothing near crisis stage at this point in time, though we also see signs of an emerging backlog. There's certainly a divergence between what the city can afford to borrow each year and the list of needs for which it ostensibly should be borrowing, and that gap is growing. It's when we look at Milwaukee County that we really see this very, very pressing problem, and that's where the backlog could reach perhaps in excess of $400 million within the next 5 years. And the simple reality is that Milwaukee County has been deferring projects every year for the better part of the last 10 to 15 years because of its fierce financial challenges. That list of backlogged projects is now so big that it's really difficult to see how the county could ever be able to dig its way out of it, both literally and figuratively, without either looking at new revenue sources, taking certain projects off the list, or in all likelihood, a combination of both.
Give us a taste of the kind of projects you're talking about there in Milwaukee County that are big areas of concern.
Well, so there are both some very large projects and dozens upon dozens of smaller projects. So just starting briefly with some of the larger projects, the county has a safety building that is attached to its courthouse complex that houses some very important public safety functions, including district attorney's offices and jails and so forth. That building, quite frankly, has been obsolete for several years, and it has now reached the point that by early in the next decade, the county needs to look at a full replacement, which could cost up to $300 million. We have the Milwaukee County Domes, one of the foremost visitor attractions in the county, that has had all sorts of issues with falling concrete. Plans are still not in place as to whether there's going to be repairs or replacement or even something new, but the price price tag there could be in the tens of millions of dollars. We also have the Milwaukee Public Museum that is searching for a new facility. Right now, they're in a county-owned building, and potentially there would be a county cost involved in terms of finding them a new place. So those are some of the big projects, but again, it's in the county parks where there are just dozens upon dozens of deferred projects with regard to paved assets like parkways and walkways and tennis courts and basketball courts, parks, pavilions, ball fields, et cetera. And you add all of that up, and it's a very large number.
Well, you talk about solutions in your report on both ends. Let's start on one, the idea of getting rid of some of these facilities. Is that an option on the table?
I think it has to be. And clearly, nobody wants to think about doing that. And, you know, very clearly, if it's the park in your municipality where an asset may have to be relinquished, that's not going to sit very well with you. But the reason that we say that really, in particular, the parks and recreational assets have to be looked at is that those are not mandated by the state of Wisconsin. The county has to take care of its mandated functions first, having to do with public safety and health and human services, for example. So I think there's going to have to be a need to look at that and some real tough questions about whether some of these real big attractions like the domes and like the public museum can still be publicly owned.
And as we wrap up, Rob, on the other side, you mentioned possible new revenue sources. Is there something lurking out there that would be politically possible?
Well, I think that's part of the problem is that right now, the county and the city, for that matter, their hands are tied because of the revenue structure we've set up. There would need to be state authorization to do anything outside of either the property tax or the wheel tax. So to consider, for example, a temporary local sales tax to try to eat into some of this backlog would require legislative approval in Madison. Whether that is politically feasible, I think, is certainly out of my league to answer. But really, a sales tax of all the other revenue choices would probably make the most sense in terms of the fact that you would be able to charge essentially the consumers of services within these jurisdictions for part of the cost of the infrastructure.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
That's Rob Henkin, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, with us to talk about his group's latest research on infrastructure in the metro Milwaukee area. You can read the Picking Up the Pieces report. It's linked at WPR.org. The Milwaukee area isn't alone when it comes to big questions about infrastructure spending. Cities, states, and the federal government are all dealing with aging roads, bridges, and buildings. Dan McNichol is with us, journalist and writer who covers infrastructure spending and transportation. He's the author of a number of books on the topic, including The Roads That Built America. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Rob.
Well, you just heard the story in Milwaukee County government in particular there from Rob. Is Milwaukee County alone, or are we seeing this all over the country?
Well, there are about 20,000 incorporated towns in America, and I would say, and I haven't been to all of them, but I've been to a lot of them, and I would say Milwaukee, Wisconsin in particular's issues are a national issue.
How did we get here? How did we end up in a state where we have so much infrastructure that is ready to be repaired or replaced, and we're not financially prepared for it at many levels of government?
That's an excellent question. I think we're the victims of a lot of wealth and a lot of success, and we've built a lot of infrastructure, but we just haven't maintained it. And we're underinvesting. There's devolution going on. When you hear about rural roads and rural bridges being either, as you were talking with Rob earlier about just not building them, tearing them down, not repairing them, you're seeing that in rural areas especially because the cost of maintaining these roads and then even the cost of raising the level of quality of that road is cost prohibitive. And there's a downward trend on building. We are investing a lot less in our infrastructure than we did in the 50s and the 60s when we were building great projects like the interstate highway system. And today, no one wants to pay. No one wants to contribute. I'm being a little facetious, but you have a trend, even in liberal states, whether they're red or blue states or purple states, there's a trend not to invest in our infrastructure.
Dan, I've heard at least from a couple policy people over the years that if you're a politician, building a new road, a new bridge, a new building, that's sexy. Properly funding the 50-year road rotation maintenance plan, not sexy. Is that part of the problem?
Yes, it completely is. There's a wonderful book called Divided Highways, and on the cover of that book, it talks about the interstate highway system. But Tom Lewis's book, it has a wonderful picture in Wisconsin of a ribbon cutting, and it's in the 1950s, and they're opening up a section of, I believe, I-94. And they have Miss Asphalt and Miss Concrete out there, and their gowns. They have cars and flags and banners and bunting, and it's just a wonderful way to bring a lot of attention to yourself if you're that politician fortunate enough to cut the ribbon on a piece of infrastructure. But you're right. You put money into a sewer. You put money into repairing things. There's no celebration, which I think there probably should be, and there's no recognition for that politician. So sadly, very few politicians lead in this category, and a lot of them are just chasing the next project that they would probably like to put their name on.
Dan, we hear numbers. I want to go to the federal level now. President Trump came into office saying, hey, I'm going to do $1 trillion, and then he met with congressional Democrats, and what number were they throwing out? $4 trillion? I mean, are they just throwing out big numbers, or are they actually inventorying what we need, figuring out what needs to go into it?
Rob, I used to try to get my arms around these numbers, and I have to admit, I've backed away from the numbers because nothing is happening anyway. And with deferred maintenance, those costs multiply so quickly. When you talk about repairing a road that's in good condition, your costs are minimal. When you talk about repairing a road that's gone through several winters where maybe potholes weren't even filled, that's a total rebuild. So it's hard to even chase that number, what is the total that would be needed to be spent to improve our infrastructure. But and I'd like to move beyond anecdotal measures, but I have to tell you, nothing is being done. And what's alarming is that it's taking longer to do what little we are doing. For example, in New York City, the Second Avenue subway, that's a 16-station subway line when it's finished. It took 100 years to get the first three stops built. There are a lot of backstories on that, but the simple fact is it took 10 years and $5 billion to build three stations on the Upper East Side of New York. Meanwhile, between 2010 and 2015, the Chinese have built a couple thousand miles of subways in their first and second tier cities.
Now, that can get difficult because China might use what we call eminent domain a little more liberally than we're able to in this country. I mean,
they can move
people out of the way while they fix stuff like this or build stuff like this.
But the reality is, regardless of their government and their ability, their centralized government, their provincial governments, they are building these structures. So you can whine and complain about us having a democracy, a messy democracy. It takes longer. We take care of the environment. That's not all true. We're waylaid with environmental process. That is deferring new construction from starting. And when we're finished, we have spent so much money, taken so much time, and delivered so little infrastructure that affects us on the global market. That affects the ability to compete globally. And it doesn't matter what government you have or what the reasons are you're not building. If you're not building, you're losing. And when I say building, I mean, I'm assuming that we're building smart systems in our ports, in our rails, in aviation, the grid, on down the line.
We're talking to Dan McNichol about how local, state, and national governments are struggling to maintain infrastructure in the United States, why this could be a bigger and more costly issue down the road. Dan, infrastructure is kind of a distant, abstract word. Do you think in our daily lives we're feeling the impact of not putting enough into fixing stuff, or are we going to be soon?
Well, there are some advantages and disadvantages about obsessing about infrastructure, and I can tell you, I've been watching the word in the media, and it is ballooning. It is now commonplace, and it wasn't 5-10 years ago at all. So I'm encouraged by this. This is a healthy discussion, and when people start focusing on these issues in a messy democracy that is America, which I love, these solutions will bubble up eventually. We tend to obsess, think, debate, and then we finally do the right thing, but only after, I think, too much time has passed.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Gary on the line in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Yes, good evening or good afternoon, guys. I got a couple comments. One, when we're repairing infrastructure and rebuilding it, we had to do it the most cost-effective way possible, whether it's union jobs or not union jobs. But second, and to me more interesting, is when we were building large amounts of infrastructure using taxes in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, we were spending way less money on other social services and things. And I don't know if that's ever been studied and sort of what percent we're spending now versus then, but we've got ourselves in the problem of more and more and more for government and more and more and more taxes, and eventually they're just too much.
Gary, thanks for your call. Dan, your thoughts?
Yeah, Gary, I think it's an excellent point, and I do agree with you on building them, building whatever we're building. You have to imagine it being like your home. You just want it done well, and you want it to last, and the longer that it lasts, the less it actually costs. And those life cycle costs are really important to look at. But there's no question we're in a much more sophisticated, much more complex society than we were in the 1950s. But there's no excuse for backing away from what we need. And I believe, Gary, that, for example, defense, I think foreign policy begins at home. And I'm following Dwight Eisenhower's actions and his policies, not my own, when I say anything that's good for the country and the economy is good for our national security and our military. And he was talking mostly at that time about roads. And in 1919, he went across the United States in a military convoy, the first military motorized convoy to cross the United States. It took 2 months. They destroyed 88 bridges in just Wyoming. And it really made a point to him, and he mentioned this in his book called At Ease, Stories I Tell to Friends, that this, he wrote a whole chapter about this convoy. And it drove him to build the interstate system because he knew that the economy would greatly benefit. Loss of life on the road would drop significantly, which it did. The interstate system is the safest road in the world. And it spurred development like no one's business. It brought health care and better jobs to areas like the South, the Deep South, that were suffering at the time. And those are the kind of investments that we're not making, that other countries are making, and we continue to sink in world rankings as far as our global competitiveness.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Dan McNichol is with us. He's an author. He writes about transit and infrastructure issues, talking about infrastructure spending in the United States. Back to your calls now. Rob is with us in Wausau. Rob, hello.
Hi. I work in a factory building bridges, and even if we had more money available, there simply isn't the workforce willing to do the work. Like, I work 50 to 70 hours a week. They pay us double time over 50, and for every 10 people that they hire, 9 of them are gone a week later.
Rob, thanks for the call. Rob, seeing a labor shortage in doing this kind of stuff, Dan.
Well, hot economy will do that, and I agree. This is a dilemma on two fronts. When you have the money and you can build it, how do you get the help? A lot, and very unfortunately, you see more and more outsourcing. We're just not able to do the work that we used to do in this country, especially with metal fabrication. I worked on the Bay Bridge project out in San Francisco, a magnificent rebuild of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, and the section between Yerba Buena Island and Oakland was rebuilt at about $7 billion. A big chunk of the really magnificent part of that bridge was built in China, where 8,000 or so workers were employed to build the bridge in sections. The sections were lowered into ships, giant hulls. Ships brought them over, unloaded them, and about 160 iron workers in San Francisco, Oakland assembled the pieces. So I think we're going to see a lot more prefabrication like he's speaking of.
Thanks for the call, Rob. Time for another caller. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I think the guest has kind of talked a little bit about what I was going to say, is that one of the things we did in Wisconsin was eliminate the prevailing wage requirement for local projects, but I don't believe we did it for statewide projects. But, you know, we really need to be outsourcing these functions to the best provider, which includes sometimes the best cost or the best value, which impacts cost. And we don't do enough of that, so I'd like to see the cost come down.
Steve, thanks for the call. Are there things that government entities can do to control the cost better, Dan?
Well, you know, I often wonder this, and have spoken to many experts, economists, on the cost of labor, and it's significant. Even Eisenhower kept two sets of records when he was rebuilding his home on Gettysburg, and he wanted to know what it would have cost if he had not used union labor, and his estimate was almost twice. But I bristle a little bit at putting this on the back of labor. I think this is more about what are we spending money on and why aren't we spending more on the areas that we really need to spend more on? For example, fiber optics. You know, as people get more and more concerned and more come to the table about global warming or sea rise or however you want to describe it, there's more and more pressure to not move about, not to burn carbon. And fiber optics could, 5G, we've been hearing a lot about it in the news lately, but the 5G network, it's like electricity was in the 1930s. We need to bring fiber optic high-speed internet into people's homes so they can telecommute, so they can be traveling all around the state and the country or the world if they have to and never leave their home. And that would put a lot less pressure on roads, a lot less pressure on rail, a lot less pressure on airports and traveling, and it would make it for probably a healthier world. But we just haven't done that because the Verizons and the Comcast of the world are, and understandably, it's not evil, they're just guarding their investments. But if we opened up the internet like we have with utilities, water, electricity, I think we'd see a remarkable return on investment.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, I've been a real pleasure. I love Wisconsin. Thank you for having me.
That's Dan McNichol, journalist and writer who covers infrastructure spending and transportation. He joined us today to talk about the state of our infrastructure in the United States and challenges facing governments. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, President Trump met with North Korean leadership again. We'll get the latest on that meeting and efforts to contain North Korea's nuclear weapons development. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, how seriously should you take expiration dates on your food? Is it a solid deadline or more of a suggestion? Kate and her guest look at the rules behind food safety. It's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we talk about the future of gerrymandered legislative districts now that the Supreme Court is bowing out of that discussion. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.